It depends how you define nothing.
It kind of does, huh? Yeah.
That's ironic.
What choice do we have?
It's a fine nothing. Well, I have nothing to grab a hold of. Where do you start?
Yeah, really, it's the same as any other conversation we've had. It's like
same as it ever was.
This is nothing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not being dismissive of the texture of your present experience. It's just the observation that whatever you make of this from time to time, if you make anything of it at all, is arbitrary. Mm-hmm. It's an arbitrary assignment.
It's all perspective ridden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, where does the arbitrary interpretation come from?
Why that particular brand of arbitrariness?
Yeah.
Sure.
Because you're sort of programmed that way, right? I mean, you know.
Well, what's arbitrary for, you know, an Asian, a Northern, Southern, Mediterranean, European, the South, the North, the East, the West, the Central United States, right? The Canadians, the Alaskans. I mean, everywhere you go, the flavor of arbitrary association with the texture of reality has its own flavor, its own vocabulary, its own language, its own sentiment, its own morphogenic, right, impulses.
Yeah. And you know, when we say arbitrary, it seems to me it's only arbitrary because we can't pin it down.
Okay.
You know that it's absolutely determined. It's just we don't know what the hell determines it. I mean, it's just too complex. It's just this.
You mean like how it arises?
Well, I mean, that's
really determined in a hot-cold environment.
If all things were known in one moment, you could possibly assume that the next moment could be predicted. But all things are known.
Well, it curiously, you know, defies any kind of logic, right, that you could apply. Because even what it is that's happening, happened, will happen, or let's say there's an interest in some kind of predictability or control over, right, management of the odds. Like, take out a bunch of insurance on the World Trade Towers more or less shortly before they are decimated. Someone could say that's kind of like a certain management of the odds, right? Manipulate the markets by virtue of geopolitical events. You know, the high art of insider trading, right?
They don't got it all. They're just taking crap out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. One can relax from the presumed necessity for meaning or any form of arbitration. Without content. It's hard to whip one's apprehension into gear. and psychological apprehension, right, insists on content, on some conveyance, as like what's going to happen to me if such and such, then such and such, if this, then that, right? What's going to happen to me?
Kind of like a weather report. What relevance has it if you're not body-centered?
Yeah, that's...
You don't even have one.
If you are body-centric, you can't necessarily fake not being body-centric. So...
Well, sure, you can fake it to some degree, you know.
Fake it.
Hard don't know how successful it'll be, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's it could be try to affect a certain sort of, it's all cool kind of thing, but.
Yes. Yeah.
If there's hunger.
Yeah, no bridge, it's such a confusing maze or something.
Yeah.
Because from what you're saying is like, it doesn't matter, right? So you could have the, what about me, angst?
But yeah.
It doesn't, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't amount to much.
It doesn't amount to much. It doesn't mean anything,
right,
to say.
Right. But one can still be symptomatic, right?
Yeah.
Right. Symptomatic means there's, you know, the presence of apprehension and anxiety is not just, is not just a passion. Very uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. Somatically and psychiatrically, emotionally, in whatever forms you might measure your present experience. If one is consumed by apprehension and anxiety and paralysis and overwhelm, right? Or various addictive proclivities, which visit upon you without your, you know, signing up for them, then you could say you got quite a mess on your hands.
Yeah, I mean, and there are times, you know, but this was, again, human, like, you know, there could be, like, great sadness and despair, but
oh, yes.
Also, you know, there is something mixed about that, you know.
Yes.
A joyful despair.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah, we're mixed all the time.
Yeah, mixed all the time.
Yeah.
But doesn't it seem like there has to be some letting go of all that, which means that it's sort of going to drift away a little bit. So if it's not going to capture you, yet you can still sense it, or yet you can still see it, you know. You say, oh, man, you know, this is sad, you know, I'm feeling sad, you know. So you have this, it's almost like a dissociation, right? I mean, you know, there's this part of you that knows there's sadness and feels sadness, but yet there's this part of you that's kind of just absorbing that, you know. Or is it maybe a part is not the right word. But it seems like if you truly are beyond this attachment of all these types of things and emotions and stories and all that stuff, it's not going to affect you that much, you know?
Well, you would think, you know, like if that Nisar Gadada is not going to sound like Woody Allen, probably, you know?
Like, yeah, right.
That would be hilarious.
Yeah.
But yeah, Woody Allen might be, you know, who knows, right? We don't know.
Right. Besides falling in love with Mia Farrow's adopted daughter, we can't really say much about him.
Besides making him out to be a total perv.
It's hard to reach any definitive conclusion about Woody Allen.
What does he say? He's like, people say, oh, you're going to live on in your movies. And he says, I don't want to live on in my movies. I want to live on in my apartment and watch, like, Nick. <you know? laughs>
That's pure Woody Allen. He does crack me up. Well, it's funny because, you know, he came off as one kind of a person, and all of a sudden we know about this dark inner secret type thing. But if you take somebody like R. Crumb, you know who R. Crumb
is?
Yeah. Keep on trucking.
I mean, his darkness was always right out there. I don't know. I have no problem with him at all. There's no, and I guess if you're honest about it, that, it's a whole different matter than if you're kind of a sneaky guy.
You know, it's funny. I was trolling YouTube videos and somebody had the intro. You know that thing you always say about, we're trying to take over the world thinking? No, it was some intro to some random YouTube whatever that came up.
Well, I'm glad somebody also caught on to that. Did something with it.
The real hammer is you occupy your present experience from a, you could say a transhuman dimensionality. That's the hammer, because everything else just turns out to be humanesque conjecture, right? Right, humanesque fantasy. What ifs and if so's and if onlys.
Yeah, this is what Nisargadatta is thinking and feeling. This is what everybody else is thinking.
Right, which is a fun contrast, of course. Yeah.
Humanesque, I don't know.
Like, you know, letting stuff go. I mean, good luck being a human letting stuff go.
Yeah, all right.
Because whatever you let go of is, you know, going to smack you on the back of the head like a boomerang.
Yeah.
Right? Before you've even finished burning the, you know, the piece of paper to complete the ritual of the letting go. You know, it'll be boom. It'll hit you in the back of the head.
Well,
I don't like to take it that far just in case anymore.
Yeah.
Let's wait till after lunch and see how I feel.
Right.
It'll probably change by then.
And you know, human mind, whatever that might suggest, is a professional bargainer. Mm-hmm. Right? We're always bargaining. You know, no matter how sure we are of a thing or how committed we feel, we've always got a caveat or a million of them, you know, back. So we might turn out to be a little frustrated because we can't really believe in anything with all that much interest or confidence. And I think the people that do turn out to believe or pretend to believe in things with, you know, profuse confidence or, you know, they're a little frightening to me because that's kind of a, you could say, an imposition of a rigidity that forces the otherwise vague humanesque-ness into, you know, a certain kind of fixity. Yeah. So there's a certain violence that occurs when one becomes fundamentally enamored or loyal or superstitious about any one thing. Because the reality of the texture of one's present experience is absurdly, you know, vague and loaded with caveat and nuance, and I'm not quite so sure, and how does this feel? But oh, it's gone, and you know, now what are you? And now I'm this, and you know, so to impose a certain belief system, which is firm and unyielding, seems counter to how the seasons change and how life flows and how the cosmos and the ocean currents and the, you know, magnetosphere and everything else just, you know, does what it does. Yeah,
it's so ever changing. I mean, maybe you just continue to like more beliefs as you go along, and you realize, like, I don't even have a belief because last year I believed less.
Well, that's the, yeah, that could be the fun part. I mean, here's the moment where the cosmic delivery person can hand you your get out of belief free card.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Every moment.
Like, I believe I like popcorn.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I want tomorrow.
Yeah. Right. Well, let's say there are beliefs that emanate from the sense of you. You have certain beliefs. It could be food preferences, you know, could be religious, right? Any manner of accoutrement, right? Emotional, psychiatric, spiritual, identity, conformity, chaos, anarchistic, even, right? Tendencies are all within the field of a belief, right? How you roll, what you like. And how about prior to that? Before you are sufficiently congealed to even have a belief, what are you? You can just drop completely out of the sense of even being capable of possessing beliefs. Otherwise, it's easy to get tangled in, right, our beliefs, the ones that we like, the ones that we don't like, the ones that we would like to change, the beliefs I would like you to change about yourself or about me, you know. That's when we jump into everyone else's business. We want them to change their beliefs to suit, you know, our comfort. But what if you untether from the tar baby of even being entitled to a belief?
It seems like there's got to be a lot of stillness to be untethered still.
Well, here you are. Really, with, you know, what, with whatever you got. Here you are with whatever you got. And right? I mean, are you really inhabiting this moment as a person, as a creature, as the consequence of beliefs? Are any of your beliefs, can any single one of them be held responsible or accountable for this being as it is? Not a one. So even though you may be in a place, in a space, and being on the receiving end of, let's say, some kind of data field, or you have, you know, the effulgent aliveness of discerning consciousness.
On the receiving end, you are the data field.
Yes, you can put it both ways, right? Receiving or are.
How would you be receiving?
Well, you take yourself as a body, a mind, a person, right? You know, the presence of discerning consciousness. And so you can feel as if you're on, you know, right, receiving.
Well, yeah, if you're
right,
crazy.
Yes.
Like everybody.
Yeah. Well, this is the...
We're all pretty crazy.
It's not important necessarily whether you're receiving or you are that, you know. It's just, this is so, and must you inhabit this from the point of view of being a creature? Being at risk? Being responsible? Having to have even a single belief?
You know, I find that as I go along and I, there are certain things, it's not a thought process, it's just a sense, feeling or whatever, of a certain depth. And when I say depth, I guess I mean maybe truth or something real, something that rings, something that's irrefutable, and then I have, like, mostly of other stuff, just stuff, you know, that doesn't seem to go anywhere. And
yeah.
I would say that if it makes any sense, you know, I sort of am learning to trust that. But, you know, if I would actually try to say it to anybody outside in this room, it would be very hard to express. I mean, for them to understand what I'm getting at. And I almost sometimes have to question myself, am I going out on a limb here? This is just, you know, it like, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. Well, can
you inhabit your own experience with, you know, let's just say varying degrees of confidence?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, vacillating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, to speak to these observations, I have issues. Right? I mean, to speak about the, what would you say, the curious texture of consciousness. I don't know, requires a certain kind of madness, right?
And a certain kind of willingness, in a sense, to allow yourself to be the center of it all. Because I could certainly talk to, say, my wife.
Yes.
And she would see it, probably, who knows, as me being the center of the universe.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite likely. But there it is. You know, I am who I am. I mean, you know, but the center of the universe is just, it can expand into whatever.
So let's say there's a self or a sense of self that could turn out to be fond of something called freedom, right? So this sense of self wants freedom to appear as a symptom to itself, as an accoutrement of some kind, right? And so naturally, we fetishize or objectify something as luscious as freedom from the point of view of something happening. I'm not really sure, you know. It's difficult to nail down what you might mean by freedom or what you might mean for yourself by the word peace or fuck, enlightenment or something weird like that. You know, what do you mean by that? What's the, how does it roll? You know, how would you like it to visit upon you or occur? You know, what superhero or sage, you know, would you like to emulate? You know, I mean, are you kind of a Green Lantern enlightened person or like an Aquaman enlightened person, Wonder Woman maybe for some?
Yeah. All of them.
Yeah.
I have an infinity ring.
Yeah, see. So. Right. So what do we...
More like the Green Lantern.
You know, okay, so peace, freedom, compassion, equanimity, stream entry, right? Non-dual, right? Jhanic subtlety, twirling dervishes.
What kind of superhuman power do you want?
Yeah, right. You want to run really fast, like the Flash.
Yeah. Maybe that's why people like superhero stuff so much.
Yeah. Yeah, because their powers are somewhat defined.
Yeah. Well, they feel that way. We feel like really minuscule and sort of.
Yeah. And
random
access.
Random access, useless powers, yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
Well, yeah, if you're like, you know, a little tiny person running around in an average life, if that's really what you take yourself to be,
mm-hmm.
it's not looking too superhuman. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like pretty pathetic, mostly. You know what I mean?
Yes. Could be.
Hearing about, like, people, so-called enlightened people, people say, oh, well, there's nobody there, you know. But wouldn't that be true of everybody? So why would that be more? So then...
It's really interesting to see how so-called enlightened people strut their stuff, right? Whether on a more intimate, you know, basis where they're not, what, teaching or proving anything, right? Taking your money for in exchange for some kind of, you know, experience, right? Or,
yeah,
or
if, something to do, some reason to get out of bed.
Yeah, you know, or... If, yeah, I mean,
yeah,
know.
Because our pathetic little lives suck. We need something so we can get out of bed.
Time, so I might as well become an enlightened teacher. Like,
may as well.
So much television you
watch. There's only so much television you can watch.
Well, you hear about, you know, they have a flow of emptiness or, you know, or.
Yeah.
But then, you know, and then it's funny, like, filtering it through my active ego, you know, sometimes I'll feel like, oh, that was it, you know, you come back, like,
yeah,
like the avatar thing, like, you're back, you know, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know what I'm saying.
neither do we, that's okay.
Just rifting.
Yeah. Yeah.
If the ultimate there's nobody there and there's nothing going on, then how can you even sort of identify enlightened people?
Oh.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying you are, I'm just saying.
No, yeah, I don't know. You might have to check their buttocks for the circle E.
Oh, Cabbage Patch stamp.
Circle E Ranch.
Goes on hot.
I read some articles we did said, oh, people who use psychedelics are less likely to be suicidal. And I was wondering, like, why? Like, what is it?
Yeah.
You saw that too?
Yeah, I don't remember where.
It was a tweet. One of my tweets.
It was a tweet.
This stuff goes around, you know. If it's going to be one place,
it's going to be another. Yeah.
It could go the other way, right? If you've done hallucinogens,
yeah.
You might be like more easeful when it came to suicide.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, isn't that the what's behind, you know, what they say about so many of the antidepressants, there is an increased risk of suicide sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because it's like,
what the hell?
It's a big deal, you know.
Well, that could be true.
Yeah. It's like their active depression is lifted, but it's because they're not investing in all of this stuff so much. You know? It's like,
Yeah, well, some people say, they start feeling, you know, like that they start feeling good enough to take action. Some people say that.
Yeah. Oh. Like the other.
They have a little more energy now. They can actually conjure the energy to get out of bed and kill themselves.
Really?
Yeah, like I
can tie a knot.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I actually have enough energy to get out of bed and get a rope.
Yeah.
Tie a knot.
Mom, I'm going out to the hardware store. Oh, that's good.
I'm feeling better.
Somebody's surrounded
to a red Really? Thinking of going climbing? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Got this nice thick nylon. A couple of carbiners. Binders.
I mean, because it's like interesting, like with the psychedelics, like what would make people, maybe because they know that if it's a multiverse, like I always feel better when I get up and remember a dream. I sort of feel like, okay, there's some more worlds in this, so that's cool. You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's time to go to the Greyhound station and just grab a toothbrush, head out. Do something completely out of character, right? Go to Nogales, see if Don Juan might show up at the Greyhound station.
Yeah, it used to be easy to Nogales. You could just walk over to the end border and then walk back.
Yeah.
You gotta have a passport. And
I know, yeah.
You gotta scale a wall.
Get kidnapped over there.
Oh, yeah. You know, just because your mind is capable of free associating and illuminating itself with remarkable chatter doesn't mean you have to give it any attention.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so what that you can think faster than Speedy Gonzales?
Yeah, I see it sometimes as a palliative.
Mm-hmm.
Get a giggle and a chuckle out of it. Maybe because the moment is a little bit too much.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, part of the yogas, regardless of which one, they will naturally cultivate, you know, a different orientation to present experience. You don't have to make a big issue out of being, you know, even keeled or something silly like that, or whatever transcendental meditation promises you, like lower blood pressure, higher creativity, less sleep, greater likelihood of meeting someone interesting at a bar.
Less temper tantrums.
Get that guy here and see what he has to say.
Who?
Maharishi Mahesh Yogi?
Yeah.
We'd have to bring him back.
Get some, yeah.
Back from the dead.
He's dead.
Long. Yeah.
We'll get someone that can channel him. Don't worry.
And you know, his ashram was closed to Westerners in the 80s. So now it's just for the Indians. He says, you can see someone in the United States. It was Rishikesh. They said, no, you're not allowed in here.
A certain international organization at this point.
That was 1984. But you know, it's interesting. Interest is focused in one area and then all this attention, and then it gets to be a burden, and then the gates are closed because all this attention is it's a misattention in a way. Would I want that kind of attention? No, I would not. It's a burden. I kind of like being anonymous and once in a while kind of standing out and then being anonymous again. It would kind of be a drag.
Are you talking about like being involved in a sales organization like TM or Ocho?
Being Jim Carrey or somebody that everyone
celebrity.
Yeah, celebrity of sorts, whether it's a spiritual celebrity or just, you know, some famous face, it would be like all this importance. It's like, oh, you know who I saw at Starbucks?
And not only important, but you got to toe the line of whatever it is you said in the past. Because at this point, you know, you can't go back on what you said, or you won't be consistent. You'll be seen
as
a fraud.
Your books are documented, and then
that's right. And they'll throw it back in your face.
And then you're Paula Deen, and you're like totally.
Well, that reminds me of Picasso's dilemma. he'd do something and they'd say, that's brilliant, do more of that. And he'd say, no, don't. He'd do something else. Oh, that's even better, do more of those. I'm done with that. But yeah, there's that achieving sort of a peace in the human condition. And then accomplishment. And this, the hero worship, you know, the superhero. Boy, wouldn't it be nice if I had these powers? Maybe not. Then everyone would be like knocking down your door saying, why did you save that world?
Yeah.
So why were you hanging out in the coffee shop and not saving Mars?
Well, that's the Jesus Christ superstar thing, right?
Yeah, leave me alone. Christ, and then just get the massage.
From the 70s called Resurrection, where she had healing powers and that.
Ellen Burstyn.
Yeah, that was a good movie.
It was good.
Yeah.
Which one?
Spooky. Resurrection, I think it was called.
Yes. Yeah. That was great.
Yeah, it was good.
I don't think it's so much.
She finally found peace in perfect anonymity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that wasn't the one where she could heal. And mm-hmm. She was on the side of the road. She found that she had this just kind of joint, you know, on the side of the road, and the person came by and she sort of healed the little kid.
Like, yes.
At the end of the movie, she does heal.
Oh, that was terrific.
Cancer.
That.
Yeah.
That's called Resurrection.
I didn't know that was what it was.
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
That was the cool movie because, that's what happened to her. But she wasn't towing the line with the religious faith.
Mm-hmm.
So they were letting her have it.
No, I think she was getting weaker, or am I thinking of the Dead Zone? I forget.
My memory of it is that she was a healer, but she wasn't attributing it to Jesus or God or something like that. She just said, this is what I do, I can heal. But she wasn't, from what I can remember, attributing it to their particular faith. So, you know, they got, where's this coming from? You know,
yeah, they got hijacked.
Right. It's not from the source, the proper authority, then it must be from the other.
Yeah.
But that falls back on the belief in how endless that loop is of satisfaction and dissatisfaction, conflict. You know, talk about freedom. It's like, I have the belief of beliefs, now I'm free. Uh-oh, somebody found me out. They want to steal it. I go on to run now, fugitive. It's crazy.
We occupy our presence, present engagement, the quality of being, you know, through anecdotal representation, which is, you know, fantasy. So the yoga, whatever the means and handles are, is to discover something, you could say tangible, palpable, reliable, felt. Just here, just now. Somehow we, you could say relax or take some joy, nachas, it's called in Yiddish, right? From this moment. And it's not psychiatric, you see. When we're dwelling in abstraction or hypotheticals or storytelling or reminiscences, that's psychiatric. That's a movement of, you know, memory and association. I mean, it's sparkly, you know, it's spontaneously arising, but it's kind of content driven, right? So our attention then is with content.
Is it possible to have content and no content?
Yes, of course. Yeah. So your attention is just as capable of feeling yourself, feeling that this is so. And you can become just as fascinated or delighted in the textural observation that this is so, which is felt.
So content doesn't negate anything.
No, it can't. Yeah. Yeah. Content is always at hand because this is so imaginative.
Always at hand?
Always. Sure. Yeah, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form, right? It's not like there's a few moments in the day where the emptiness is predominant. Though a yogi that gets up at 3:30 in the morning, you know, to do her ritual, would say, "Oh yeah, you know, it's pretty content chill."
Yeah,
right.
So.
At 3:30 in the morning.
Seems content chill.
Yeah, sure. So there can be times of the day or places to go, right? Or nice clothing that you enjoy wearing that assists you in being content free. Yeah. But again, being content free could suggest the refusal of something. And that's not a very viable approach. Refusal can never really be a very viable approach. You want to accentuate the positive, meaning you feel yourself present and you discover strangely that it's enjoyable to feel yourself present, to relax in your own atmosphere. Your own auric signature, if you will. And that holds your interest. It holds your fascination. It's not boring or restless. You are you. And as you are you and you relax or enjoy being you are you, you organically untether from content. You untether from belief, superstition, anecdotal reference, hypothetical situations, comparisons, all the beautiful stuff of mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so many hypotheticals. But wait, what about this?
Yeah, right. And I mean, that's what mind is. Mind is more or less, wait, what about this?
Yeah.
For some reason, I was thinking about things you would notice something out of the ordinary on a walk,
mm-hmm.
and would start barking because one thing is out of place,
mm-hmm.
and bringing attention to it. And I'm thinking of it now because that's like my mind in a way. If I'm in that mode of a survival mode,
right?
That attention that like I need to notice these things. I need to compare what's expected to what is not expected.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a not accusing you of anything, but for all of us, that's kind of a neurotic condition. Right.
Just start barking for no reason.
That's right.
Like there's a stick here.
So you can be, let's just say, perfectly yourself, perfectly present, which is nothing special. I mean, I'm not, don't do anything. and curiously disinterested in hypotheticalism.
Your own neurosis.
Yeah, you can you can actually feel yourself unafflicted by your own charming neurosis.
Because you're an engineer, because engineers are trained to use their minds to think of hypotheticals.
What is that? It's nothing to do with anything.
Well, I have a part of my brain is
one of. Are you talking about yourself?
No, it's just a little part. Mm-hmm. When it's active,
I know what you mean.
When it's active, I've been accused, and I confess, of coming up with scenarios just one after the other. And thinking, oh my God. It's such a busy mind, all these scenarios are coming up.
That's hypotheticalism.
Right.
Yeah,
that's not a good engineering now, but that's the neurotic, never-ending sort of, like, I need to, or...
Does that ever go away, or what?
Well, fortunately, it's not active a lot of times. When it is, it's busy. It's distracting in a way.
Well,
because like you said, there's this, and the hypothetical is really busy with conjuring out of imagination and going, wait, don't bother me right now. I'm busy with my inner world, and the world is very alive around you. I mean, I used to argue back and say, well, that's just as valid. I think it's like artificial sweetener or something. You're amusing yourself, and the world is happening around you in the far vaster, and I would say satisfying ways, but that's kind of, I don't know, that might create another.
Yeah, what if it's all the same?
Going on and on.
Yeah, it's like an obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, it just always, and I have it too, so.
Well, this is obsessive compulsive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Reality is, you know, obsessive compulsive.
Yeah, I once saw this, like, Buddhist nun lady. She was from Asia, and she was teaching an all-day retreat. I think it was just focusing on the breath, or... And somebody said, well, when I wake up, I like to, you know, sit there and think of my dreams or something like that. And she's like, well, that's just you, like, you know, you're being controlled by your mind, you know, like you just don't give that any kind of thought, you know, like. So I got the sense that, like, she was just so, like, into, you know, being present-minded, whatever that means, and not, like, sort of being entertained by reverie in any way.
They can sometimes present that way.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of silly because, yes. I mean, this is an ongoing reverie.
Mm-hmm.
Why tether yourself to a certain stratagem of present mindfulness to the exclusion of, you know, the immersive invitation to reverie? Why dismiss reverie as being...
I don't know. Why dismiss reverie? I mean,
well, that's
a question.
Yeah, that's part of their, you know, that's part of their training.
But, I mean, I guess there is just sort of, like, more... whatever this means, more non-dual feel to, like, merging, melding with the senses.
Yeah. Well...
I
right. It's pretty...
I don't know.
Yeah, it's pretty. It's pretty basic.
Yeah.
Right. Here's yourself. You feel yourself. You notice that feeling yourself is not psychiatric.
Yeah, and the question is, if you're in reverie, can you feel yourself not being psychiatric? Like that's generally.
Well.
Psychiatric, I guess.
I don't know. I you know, I mean, I wake up a lot early.
Yeah.
I like waking up.
Yes, and I like you tell us about it a lot.
Those transitions are just beautiful.
I feel you. I do.
It's hard to argue with that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So you feel yourself with whatever skill sets or magical resources are at your disposal. And you can notice that feeling yourself attenuating to presence of experience is not psychiatric, is not referential, is not hypothetical, it's not anecdotal.
It's definitely not running the show.
And it has its own, you could say, vocabulary, right? Textural vocabulary. Feeling vocabulary. You're aware of the qualitative difference in your experience, or we could say in mind, when... Don't ever call me here. When you're just feeling yourself. Nice ring.
I see this big bell telephone.
It's the only one it's got, so...
And this, you could say, this texture of stillness, receptivity, speaks to you. It's you know, self-revelatory, self-educating. The, you know, the gift of, let's call them, convergent lineages of transmission is the gift of, you know, one human sharing freedom from content with a so-called other human. I mean, that's why you would go see, Krishnamurti, even to fill Felt Forum or Carnegie Hall or, you know, a venue. Thousands, right? Thousands in a venue. You would go because, you know, either accompanying the teaching or underneath the teaching was a certain kind of generosity. To tune into the gift of feeling yourself relaxed from hypotheticalism and anecdotal reference. So if Rupert Spear is good at what he does, he's able to convey, not so much through the teaching, but through a vibratory resonance. Enough radiation, enough exposure to that radiation gets under your skin. You find yourself capable of being self-generating. rather than the many decades, let's say, it may take that one goes to be in the company of another or others, right? To orient their meditation, to orient their contemplation to presence relieved of self.
Did you say it's really relieved of self, or just more kind of like not really concerned?
You know, they can be mutually exclusive or the same thing. It's up to you, right? Play with it as you wish. We feel ourselves, let's say, with enough frequency, sufficient frequency, right? Sufficient frequency and sufficient depth. We learn to feel ourselves relieved of hypotheticalism and anecdotal projection. We're like, oh, wow, that feels like that. I feel like that. That doesn't suck. And right over certain period of repetition, association, radiation, stumbling, failing, getting back up again, right? It could include formal practice of, you know, meditations and yogas and all kinds of things. Why not? So all of these activities assist you in slowly, gradually being self-generating. That you discover, oh, wow, shit. I mean, I didn't even go to Wayne's house today, and I feel this shit. How the fuck did that happen? You know, I missed the Peter Brown lunch, but wow, this shit is real. You know, I thought I was getting it from him, but whoa, you know, it's here. I'm by myself and it's here. Wow. That rocks. And I mean, all the Genesis stories of, you know, people that have grown in confidence of this texture, all their stories are very similar. You know, Rupert hung out with Francis Lucille, and Francis Lucille hung out with Jean Klein, and Jean Klein hung out with a Sanskrit scholar in India, and I don't know who that guy hung out with, but he hung out with somebody, right? And sometimes this arises spontaneously and self-generating without, you know,
like
the
Krishnamurti or something like that?
Well, Krishnamurti had all kinds of crazy training and initiations. Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus.
Well, you know, I mean, some people say, you know, Jesus was self-generating, and others suggest that, you know, as a younger man, he wandered in the East.
There's no self-made gurus, I guess.
Well, that chick that was going to get a cigarette.
Yeah, no, she's one.
That's awesome.
Totally self-made, yeah.
Who? I envy her. Because I just want that to be my story.
I know. I know.
So that
Yolande.
Like, all the people that think that, like, smoking is bad and there's no way that could ever get you anywhere and be like,
yeah.
Hey, fuck you. Yeah, one time on my way to get a cigarette.
Yeah. Oh, like those people who were just sort of.
So we're in a, you know, we're in a weave. We're in a weave. We're in this together is one way to look at it. And the interest is a very similar interest. It's like, oh, Can this wild shit actually not fucking bother me so much? That's one motive. You know, then there are other stranger motives that you may not even be aware of or conscious or cognizant of. Some other force of nature is flowing through you so that you would give up your precious time, your precious autonomy to do this shit.
Well, I got nothing to do.
Could be that. What's interesting is you hang out in the texture of yourself. You can still free associate, of course. You know, nothing's, no one and nothing is stopping you. You could look into the texture and quality of your present experience and learn something from it. You know, ask a question about it. Right? Engage with your own mysterious observation. It's not as easy as recalling, you know, a movie. That's easier.
Mm.
You know, because like a memory, you know, outburst is easier to get going, right? It's a little more intimate. It's a little challenging to say, oh, what the fuck am I feeling right now?
It might not be automatic.
Yeah, you have to kind of get used to it,
mm-hmm.
and feel comfortable exploring the texture of your present experience and speak right out loud or ask a question out loud or muddle through or mm-hmm. you know, yeah. That's not something that we're ever encouraged to do.
We're discouraged to do it, I mean, most of our lives.
That's right. We are discouraged from feeling ourselves and then mm-hmm. kind of free associating out loud. That's right, about the texture of experience.
Well, there definitely seems like there's a, definitely might be an overstatement, a difference between like this sort of analytical stuff and quality of something else that comes from.
You get to look at yourself absolutely fresh. Your present experience is showing up absolutely fresh. If something like memory is haunting us, then that's reference. That's a false flag event. Memory is always a false flag event. But your actual experience, whatever that implies, is not. It's fresh. It's presenting to you forthwith, heretofore. Right in your lap. Yeah,
I do get stuck though a lot on a daily basis. I go into an addictive behavior of, I don't know, just getting diverted in some stupid thing, some mm-hmm. research. I could just go into a trip where I'm like researching something or looking, investigating something. I don't need to do it. In fact, I really shouldn't be doing it. You know, I should be doing my job.
You should always be doing something else.
All knowledge of what really floats your boat.
You're probably in the right place at the wrong time.
The more I do
want to
do this, you know. It's just,
Yeah.
And I just can't see.
Well, you're the only person with that body.
Yeah. That's unique.
Yeah.
I've never heard that before. You should write a blog about it.
It's so, I find it so hard to get on.
Well, and that was all the technology.
Look,
anything else you ever wanted to know.
There's part of my brain that knows what I can get away with. I mean, it knows.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have to do anything till next week, and you'll be okay. And my mind is saying, now, this is what you're going to do today, and you're going to set it up so you don't miss these goals. Just sail right on by. I get one thing done where I want to get four things done. It's just excruciating.
Well, if it's all just doing itself, then all that self-talk like, come on, get it together. We don't even have to have that, right?
Yeah, but then it's like giving in. It's like, oh, well, I won't do anything. It's like,
yeah. Yep.
You just figure, you know, you've gotten this far in life so far.
Well, see, there is this notion of getting lost in all this. And in that case, being obsessive about something. And I'll even catch myself counting things. You know, that's the kind of obsessiveness.
Oh, yeah.
My mind
is obsessive.
It's like, why do I have to keep counting? I mean, I don't care how many rungs there are. You know.
That's real OCD.
Yeah, I know. But there's a certain something where your attention is fixed on something. And so I'm putting that in the context of, like, what I keep referring back to, like, waking up and just sort of hanging out with different states or whatever. And, I mean, there's something that's similar, but there's something vastly different about it, though. In the only case, I guess it's my, I'm just exploring, it's just more of a mental activity. In the other case, it's not really mental. Or psychiatric, I guess we could use that term.
Yeah. You feel this. Your attention is happily partnered with feeling your present experience. And there's a certain fullness and novelty to that, which we have to be exposed to, read about, learn about, practice, right? Study, consider, strengthen the muscle of present attentivity.
Is there something in that Stan Hunter, is that his name?
Yes.
Where he was saying something about, like, saying to yourself, what was it like before I had that thought? Mm-hmm. That's a fun one to play with. I believe.
Well, here's, you know, these get-togethers is a cauldron. It's you know, this is a padded room.
Oh, a padded room.
A padded room.
It could be that too.
Okay.
Padded room, panic room. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. To do it. Right. Because we're not necessarily encouraged to feel this at home or in the workplace or whatever. So this is a chance to really lean into yourself. See what shows up. What kind of protests might show up? What kind of distractions might occur?
Just those thoughts brings that are like, wait, what about this?
Yep, this is a chance, a good opportunity.
Wait, I'll stop them.
Uh-huh. Oh. Yeah, you can use these sessions, if you will, you know, as a way of outing your distraction strategies.
Yeah, that's what this is.
It's kind of a nice space to see them in very clearly.
Yeah. Right. There's a, you know, if we're capable of creating a certain buoyancy, a certain humor, non-judgmental field for you to feel yourself, see what that's like, notice, you know, distraction tendencies, avoidant tendencies.
Judgmental, whatever, can be a very strong one, though.
Yes.
So that may be present anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, it's, but it's like, a, yeah, it's an external expressive as opposed to sitting on a mat and labeling, you know, planning or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. It's very easy to get lost in yourself and run these strategies without, you know, the benefit of a certain kind of intervention. This is a voluntary intervention. Right, rather than us coming to your house and sitting you down because you fucking lost it, right? You show up voluntarily to a group intervention, an egalitarian intervention,
and that's why it's not going to be popular. You know, how many people want to subject themselves to an intervention?
Very few.
Not very successful, I don't think.
Well, that's because it comes from the outside.
Yeah, exactly.
It comes from you.
It's because I think a lot of the conditioning says content is value. And when someone asks me, well, what did you get out of tonight? What was this? You know, what
was I remember.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Well,
the same thing I get every night. I'll have to take over the world.
Match your distraction strategy.
But see, that's the irony. It's not seen as a distraction. It's like, no, I'm very purposeful. I have a goal. And step by step, every day, in every way, I'm going towards that goal. And then the payoff is that determination and persistence will lead to my breakthrough.
If there is something worth calling freedom, it's a fair question to say, well, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, what is it?
What is it? Freedom from what? Freedom for whom? What does it feel like? How does it, why would I value it? Right? Why would I submit myself voluntarily to a, you know, group intervention just to out all of the strategies which, you know, thrive in my own private Idaho? Because I'm not really willing to, you know, cop to them or cope with them in a way that releases them from, or releases me from the bondage of those strategies.
Maybe that's the way I should put it to other people. I'm like, oh, why do you go there? It's an intervention. Oh, wow.
I could use the intervention, couldn't you? I mean, that's pretty honest, really. I value the intervention.
Yeah.
I like taking a knee to something which takes me out of my own head, takes me out of my own ideation, challenges me to feel my experience through a different lens. Right?
But not with a whole different set of beliefs.
Yeah. No. No.
That's the difference.
That's the leaving part.
That's why I'm not going to Scientology classes.
Okay. Yeah. This is not about belief replacement therapy, right? It's about, you could say, belief cessation therapy, if you wanted to refer to it as a therapy. Belief cessation therapy. Well, where do you go on those? Oh, belief cessation therapy. What?
I'll try that Sunday morning when I'm at our friends.
Yeah.
That turns the Polar Express right on the end.
Belief cessation.
Yeah. one wants to find out what is real, what is true. Is there an ultimacy, right, to the curious or dubious gift of my sentient experience? Is there a takeaway? Right? Is there the possibility of a, bless you, remarkable way of being? That's a fun adventure. I mean, that's a bit of a cliffhanger. And even though there's such a proliferation, a profuse proliferation of spoken word, written word, right? Institutions all over the countryside that dedicate themselves to this adventure. Still, it requires a certain kind of, I don't know, intimacy or availability to really go through with it. It's easy to get lost at a retreat center. It's easy to get lost in the body of some kind of teaching.
Or even meditation without inquiry.
Yes, because it's easy to fool ourselves and get taken up by these very, very crafty distraction strategies that make us feel like, oh, this is something, and I'm going to get the most out of it. We don't really, or at least few of us, want to really be challenged that intimately. Yeah. Right? Get what out of what? What do you want to get from this? Right? What's your golden ring? Maybe we should just go to the Ramana Maharshi diaper store and see if by walking around in one of those, you know, for a week, I'll start to, you know, stare out the window more. Hey, this diaper really works.
That's right. Workshop.